Today's episode of Other People is brought to you by O.R. Books, publisher of Exile, Rejecting America and Finding the World, the new book by Belén Fernández. When Fernández hit 21, she left the United States and has not looked back since. In her new book, she reflects on what it means to be an American in a largely American-made mess of a world. Exile has just hit stores and is generating enthusiastic advance reviews. Greg Grandin, author of Fordlandia, calls it, quote, a must-read how-to guide for surviving on the periphery, and journalist Liza Featherstone calls Belén's writing, quote, brilliant, hilarious, compassionate, and unflinching. Exile, Rejecting America and Finding the World by Belén Fernández, available now from O.R. Books.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have
a
friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Struggle, you know?
Incredible. You know, it's like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listy.
Just one person at just one time.
Hey, right. How's it going, everybody? Right. Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. It's nice to be with you. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you're doing well. I hope you're processing things well. I hope you have a good attitude. I'm a little concerned. I can't get it out of my head. The fact that we spend our lives staring into screens, and scientists now say that sitting in a chair and staring into screens is worse than smoking cigarettes, and staring into an iPhone can do permanent damage to your cervical spine, and eating tofu can give you man boobs. What am I talking about? When you spend 3 hours with a computer, you forget that you have a body. My guest today is Josh Gondelman. He is a multi-talented human being. He's a hyphenate. He's a writer. He's a stand-up comedian. And he's a television producer. He currently writes and produces for the television program Desus and Mero. He formerly was a writer on Last Week Tonight, the John Oliver show on HBO. And now he is publishing a book with Harper Perennial. The official pub date is September 17th, so it's about to drop. It's imminent. The book is called Nice Try, Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results. And when Josh was out here in Los Angeles just a bit ago, he was kind enough to come over here and talk with me, and I'm going to share that conversation with you right now. Here he is, folks. This is Josh Gondelman, and his book, one more time, is called Nice Try.
So I co-wrote a book a couple years ago that was like a pretty straightforward like humor book that I wrote with a friend, my friend Joe Berkowitz, who is also an author. He's on his second solo book now, and it was called You Blew It. And it was like kind of an etiquette guide that goes through the ways you've already ruined your life. Like, this is what you've already done wrong. And it was very fun, and it was like incredibly instructive because sitting in a room and writing a book and then like writing a book that you pitch and then edit and then comes out is like a totally different thing. And so it was very exciting and fun to have gone through that with a friend, and very like, it was nice to like have each other's backs on that.
Well, yeah, you can kind of distribute the pain of writing a book between two people.
Oh, absolutely. And we like edited each other. And so like there was stuff that you could enjoy wholeheartedly too. Like, you know how you can write something and you're like, I think that's good. But I could just get Joe's stuff and be like, oh, that is good. Joe did a good job. And like, he's so funny.
And how do you guys know each other?
We met, I think, maybe through the internet as well. We had pitched a different project as a book and nobody wanted it. But like, people liked us enough that we kind of got this opportunity to pitch a different kind of thing. But we had pitched a fake pickup artist guide called, I think the title ended up being Getting It Wet, The Nice Guy's Guide to Tricking Women from Friend Zone to Bone Zone.
Isn't that like what was the book? The Game?
The Game. Yeah. So it was like The Game parody, but like a few years late. And I think the industry feedback we got was that it was like funny, but nobody wants either people want the real version of the thing because they're like grimy dudes trying to have sex, or they don't want to be in that world at all. They're like, why am I interested in this character?
Yeah, so it's like, who's the audience?
Yeah,
basically.
Exactly. Which is, I like don't fully agree in that. I think you can like make something that's funny and then people like it. You know what I mean? Like they wouldn't be like, or I mean, I guess studios do, but when you make a film, it can be good because it's good. And like, especially a comedy, right? Like it almost feels like the question of like, who's Austin Powers for or whatever, like what back when those like premise based comedies were more common, or like, who is Anchorman for? It's not for people who really care about the news. It's like, you can just make the thing good enough that people will enjoy it, hopefully.
Right. There's no rules. And then like, I'm thinking too of the way that you guys are doing this, like going in and pitching a book.
Yeah.
Seems more like Hollywood, like TV stuff.
Yeah.
Like, is that, I guess sometimes people do that. You do submit like a, God, I'm blanking on the
proposal.
A proposal.
So
yeah.
That's what it was. We weren't like live pitching.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. So it was less of like a Hollywood pitch meeting and more like we sent around the proposal and like our agent kind of called the feedback for us. And it was, but it was instructive. I mean, and that is kind of uncharitable and defensive of me to say, like, just make the good thing. And like, we just like, trust us that we'll do a good enough job. It's like a little egotistical. It is good to have had that, experience though, because I think like considering who you want to read a book is important, especially because like the marketing team of a book doesn't have the bandwidth of like, well, there's going to be ads during every football game. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's that you have to like find the audience a little bit more directly and you have to like go where they live a little better. So you can't just like cast as wide a net with, especially unless it's like the new, you know, one of the books like Don Wilson, who writes the like kind of crime, who's a crime author, I believe. And his books, there's always like Subway ads in New York, and it's like, unless you have that kind of budget, you have to like figure out who you want to talk to and then find out where they live.
Yeah, you know what it comes to mind as you are talking about all of this is, I've had this thought before, I guess in the context of movies, but I suppose it would also apply to books. But like, what if a studio or like some sort of independent movie entity or an independent press or a press within one of the bigs was just like, we're not going to bet on books. We're going to bet on authors. And maybe this already exists, but like if I were running a movie studio, mm-hmm. I would just be like, get me the best directors.
Yeah.
And just let them do whatever they want. But like, they're going to live here and they're going to make interesting films. And I think the math will ultimately work out
yeah.
over time.
I wonder like, cause that's the way you want it to work, right? Is like you want like to put wings on people's creative vision as opposed to like coming in with a business plan for it, which I think kind of is how that's kind of the rumor of how I heard Creed got made after Ryan Coogler had done Fruitvale Station. That's what I heard, was they were kind of just like, well, what do you want to do? Like, tell us your idea and we're here to like let your vision happen, which is cool. But I think like ultimately, I guess they're investing so much money in it that like it's such a, I understand the impulse to want security and safety when you're putting up the money. But at the same time, I do wish like you could get more, like outside the box, like, hey, just like do a trust fall into my arms and make the project that you want. And I'm here to back it. And I do feel like, I didn't come in to this book super business minded, but like having that education and having written a book before and thought about like, well, who is it for? There is like a helpful creative point to that too, and thinking like, well, who am I talking to? Like, how am I pitching my voice? What do I need to communicate? What can go unsaid and unwritten? And like, it just is understood. And so that is kind of, I see it both ways, but like as a writer, I always just want to be like, don't worry about the premise, just make it good. Like anything can sound good or bad, you know, the premise of everything can sound good or bad. And it's 100% execution every time.
Right.
Like, you know, even the Marvel movies that are huge, that there are ones that are good and ones that are bad, or like comic book movies that are like, that are supposed to be so can't miss. And like, I guess maybe business wise are bankable, but like, you know, the ones that work and the ones that don't. And there's no difference between, to me, there's no difference between being like, the premise is Batman or the premise is Iron Man. It's like, okay, then make it good. That's the thing.
Right. Right. And I also wonder, like, when it comes to the conversations that happen, and again, like, I think this happens more often in film and television than it does in books, but there is some of this in book world. Like, how productive is that tension between, say, the business-minded side of the industry versus the creative? And, like, does it yield good outcomes? I wish there was a way to quantify it.
I know. And that, because my wife, Maris, who you mentioned before, is, like, she is, like, she's, like, an incredible believer and an incredible talent at taste, right? She's a believer in taste and has an incredible, like, eye and brain for, like, this is good. This should be in front of people, which I think is, like, so much more human and valuable than, like, the Amazon, if you like this, you'll also like that. Like, I think there's, like, a real value in, like, a person being, like, no, there is, like, a heart and soul to this that can't be captured in, like, well, you liked other books by this author, or you like other books about this topic. Because, again, it's so much about the execution and the specifics and, like, that what's poured into it, rather than just, like, this is a book about trouble in a beach town or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, get, like, big Little Lies could be great or terrible with exactly the same premise. And it's, like, nice to have a human voice kind of curating and being like, no, this is wonderful. This should be in front of you.
Well, you talk about taste, like, as a reader and as somebody, I always call it, like, betting on horses.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes you can just sense, like, this is going somewhere.
For sure.
Or this author is destined for big things.
Totally.
You can just kind of feel it.
Yep.
And you can also, I think, get some sort of weird gestalt if you're online as much as I am.
Yeah.
From, like, your Twitter feed.
I'm too online sometimes.
Yeah. Like, based on the chatter, like, I can sometimes be like, oh, people are excited about this.
Yeah.
And I just kind of have this intuition about it based on, I think, these little micro bursts of info.
The last book that I felt that about was, like, oh, this is going to be something based on just, like, the people who are excited for it was, Kristen Arnett's book that came out this summer, Mostly Dead Things, which is awesome. And, but, like, just the buzz around it, not, like, the industry buzz, but, like, the people buzz and, like, the artist buzz, you know, not, like, and the other stuff came after, right? Like, she just did, I don't know if it was Amanpour, she just did, like, a, sit down PBS interview that came, like, maybe 2 months after the launch, a month after the launch. And it's, like, because it resonated with people enough that she became newsworthy. It wasn't like, you know, she was a household name before. And so, like, obviously she's going to go on Fresh Air or whatever, you know? And I think that's so, like, it's, like, so exciting to watch someone's work be so resonant that it creates its own, like, shockwaves.
Yeah, well, no, it's, like, this kind of this melding between, like, I feel like Twitter and the persona that you see on Twitter and the wit and the fun. Like, I think a lot of people were just excited about that. And
with Kristen?
Yeah.
Yeah,
as
she's
a starting,
so funny.
As a starting point.
Yeah, she's so good on Twitter. She's so funny and, like, so just, like, great. She's just, like, delightful online. And her book, there's, like, such a deep sadness to it that is, like, very different than her online persona, but, like, clearly shows the same persona, her online, like, her writing that is online. But it's clearly, like, the same, like, brain behind it, but she just, like, focused in on the dramatic and the kind of absurd and the, like, tenderness rather than, like, the depth that she gives to, like, how much she minds the, like, joke stuff she does. Yeah, it rules. It's such a good book, and she's great. But that was the last thing that I remember. Like, and there were other, oh, you know what? It was a few books this summer, because Taffy Bredesen Eckner, she wrote Fleischman Is in Trouble. And that had a similar, like, people reading it being like, oh shit, this is going to be something real. And I feel it kind of bubbling around, Gia Tolentino's book that's coming out this week.
Yep.
And it's so nice. It's like, but that's partly because, like, that's who I'm looking at, right? I'm looking at the people who online who got advanced copies of these books and prioritized reading them and were, like, galvanized by them. And then it happens the reverse. I didn't see quite as much, like, pre-chatter, but then, like, when Linda Holmes' book, Evie Drake Starts Over, came out this summer, it felt like that hit, and people were just like, what a joy. This is, like, this is what we wanted. And it's so cool to see that, like, to see that just kind of like explode. And that's like, it's wonderful.
It's odd too, how like it's the same, because I, like two or three of the books that you mentioned, same thing in my feed.
Yep.
Like we're all seeing the same things, and maybe it's like there's this, there's like a, it seems like there's usually a volume of work that precedes the release of a book that doesn't even necessarily have to be like other books.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of Taffy, like she writes these great profiles.
Incredible profiles.
That people get like genuinely excited about. And
yeah.
Then it's like, oh, and she's got a book?
Yep. Same with Gia's writing for The New Yorker and like Linda's podcast, is that they're people that like have an audience and people are already enthusiastic. And with Kristen, who'd written, I think had written other books before, but this one was like the release it got felt larger. But yeah, I think just like, it carries over, which is nice. Like people like the other things that they're doing and are like, well, great. Like you were saying, it's like, oh, I like this person's mind. And so I'm going to bet on them as like, I bet this book will also be good.
Yeah. She's a horse, not to be reductive, but like a horse to bet on. Like I'm putting my money on,
for sure.
I'm putting my money on Arnett.
Yeah. and it's like, it's worth it. It's worth like investing mentally and emotionally and like keeping track of someone's career in the way that like you can do that with a film director, right? I think people do it to various degrees with like, there are like Tarantino acolytes who are just like, he comes out with a movie, I don't care what it's about, I'm gonna go see it. And that's, I mean, I'm that way with like the Coen brothers for sure. Like whatever they're doing, like I'm in. And I think that's great with authors too, because it lets you kind of hop with them from genre to genre, from project to project. And like, you know, Taffy going from someone who writes profiles and features to a novel, it's like not a one-to-one at all, but like that people came with her and that both things are great because she's an excellent writer, is like a really exciting and special thing.
Well, so let's talk about you then.
Sure.
in this context, because you have done a lot of work that is beloved in television. You are a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
You have a great Twitter presence.
Thank you.
You know, you have all these different pieces going. And do you feel like when it has come to the launch of your book that there has been reciprocity generated by that stuff? Like, you know, where people give the book a chance or get excited and want to champion it because they've had good experiences with you in these other contexts?
I think so. So it's hard to tell like to what degree that will continue to unfold, but people have been really encouraging about it. Not having read the previous book that I worked on with Joe, I think people have made the leap of like, I like this guy's stand up, or I like the TV shows he works on. And so I'm going to bet on this book. And because, you know, I mean, like it gets said over and over again, but it's not something that everybody knows, that like pre-orders are super huge for authors. And so to like drum that kind of enthusiasm up in advance is really helpful. And it's helpful to have had a platform prior to the book to get to do that. You know what I mean? To like have a little attention focused your way already. And I'm trying to like to bring that into as like sharp and practical focus as I can, to be like, please, if you like the work that I do, I would love for you to order this book in advance and just like trust before there are numerous reviews, if there are going to be numerous reviews, and before you can like skim it in a bookstore, trust that this will be something that will be worth your time and money. And I think people hopefully have responded. It feels, people have been very kind about it, the people that I know, and it's really lovely.
Yeah. Can you see pre-order numbers? I mean, I'm sure your publisher can.
I'm sure they can. I have not looked. I have not asked, because there's only so much that you can do. And it's like, if they're great, it would be nice to know. But anything less than like, holy shit, this is a runaway bestseller months in advance, is going to be a bummer because it's not the best it could possibly be.
Right.
So I'm trying to like stay away from that and really stay in the zone of like, the people that I love and trust have said good things about it. When I mention it online, I get good enthusiasm back. I have like a fair amount of like press and interviews and stuff. Like, this, you were gracious enough to sit down with me. And so like, I'm trying to latch on to the things that I know and are good without like probing in the dark for like, but is this also good? It's like, it's not like if the numbers are low, I can be like, well, I guess I just have to buy 6,000 copies of this book.
Right, right. Now, and it's, you know, you should, it sounds like a mentally healthy approach. You don't want to.
I'm trying.
You know, you don't want to obsess. Like, it's good to be, it's good to care. And
yeah.
It's good to pay some attention to the business elements of
For
the
sure.
process. But like, you can, that can easily become like a downward spiral.
Yeah. And I had a new stand-up album come out earlier this year, and I like intentionally didn't read press about it. And it's not because I'm very grateful for the press that it got, and I'm very grateful that people, you know, wanted to write about it and enjoyed it and would talk about it. But it's like, I like hearing nice things, but I almost feel like if you liked it, you can say it to my face. And if you did, or like tweet it directly at me, hey, I love this album, and I will be so grateful, and it will make me feel very good. But like, to seek out praise, that's the kind of threshold, because I don't believe that if you like, because people say like, well, if you let the good stuff in, you have to let the bad stuff in too. And I don't agree fully with that, but I do think once you start seeking it out, if you don't find what you're looking for, that can be very painful.
Do you get a lot of trolls and stuff on your Twitter?
Occasionally. And sometimes it kind of like flusters me for the day, or like, but usually I will just either respond or not and mute them and literally never think about them again. That's
right.
Like, I as like, you know, like a straight white cisgendered male, don't get the fucking depths of what other people get. But I think there's like that low hum of still like, actually you're wrong, or like, you suck and I rule and whatever, Trump rules, and like whoever, you know, whatever they want to put me in opposition against. And when it's just kind of that low grade, like that stuff, it's just like mute and never think about it again. And it's great. Like there's no one who I've muted on Twitter or blocked on Twitter for that stuff whose name I can remember, whose like icon I can even picture, because I fully don't value their opinions.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, you just, who has time to sit there and entertain?
Sometimes I will get people who argue, and if they are arguing a point and aren't being disrespectful, then sometimes I'll have a back and forth, because like I think that can be helpful to like to understand or try to articulate where I'm coming from. If I was making a joke and they kind of like didn't get the edges of the joke, but are responding to the content. And I think that's like, sure, if I have the time, why not? But it's like, if someone's just like, you idiot, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, why would I give a shit? Like that's the, someone smarter than me said this, but it's like, if you're having a party and someone's acting like that, you throw them out of the party. You're not obligated every time you speak with an earshot of a person, you're not obligated to endure whatever response it evokes in them for whatever reason, that, you know, whatever baggage they came in with. You're not like, it's not your obligation to like hear out everyone in the world that disagrees with you. And just because the internet makes your opinions more accessible to people that disagree with you, it doesn't make your obligation greater necessarily.
Yeah, I agree. And, I think too, I mean, it's just, it's no, like no great breaking news, but it's just an absolute cesspool of like really vile behavior.
Yeah.
People feel at liberty to just be a lot more dickish than they otherwise would be.
Someone recently was kind of being like a little sarcastic to me, but I didn't think we disagreed that much, but he just kind of came in hot because he didn't have the context for what I was saying, or like didn't grasp it right away. And I just said, hey man, I don't think we're that far off in this. Why are you being so pervasively sarcastic in your response? He like responded to me twice, and I was like, what is this? And then like, he had been away, and a couple hours later was like, oh shoot, I think I misunderstood you the first time. Sorry about that. And it's like, you can like, that's fine.
Yeah. Right.
I don't mind that. Or like, I've even disagreed with people about things and like gotten to either an understanding or occasionally persuaded someone of something. But like, I think when you're coming in just like gross and abusive, there's no need to take it. But on this, by the same token, I feel like this is a fine thing for us to discuss. But like when it gets into like Brett Stevens writing for the Times of like, when people are mean to me on Twitter, it proves that I'm right and they're wrong. And it's like, no, it doesn't. You're writing for the Times, and this is the voice that other people have to say that they disagree with you. So like, I do think that there is a great, you can learn from it. Like, and I've said things that I've later been like, oh, I was wrong about that. And people told me I was wrong. And there's a great benefit to it. But like, when people are being, you know, abusive and malicious, there's like not a lot you can, that I care to take from it. But at the same time, it's like, it's not, well, I'm a conservative and people say that I'm racist and it makes me more conservative. And it's like, no, you're justifying the thing you are already doing because you, and you're just like digging in your heels and you're not taking in criticism, you know?
So what about, in your work as a stand-up and just so people, can be oriented, you work as a stand-up comic.
Yes.
You just released an album. What's the name of the album?
Dancing on a Weeknight.
Okay. And then you write for television. Mm-hmm. What shows?
I currently write for Jesus and Marrow on Showtime. And before that, I was at Last Week Tonight with John Oliver writing for the show for 4 years. And then before that, I did the digital social web stuff for them for a year. So there for 5 years in total. Yeah.
Okay. So as a comedian, like just to stay on Twitter for one more second.
Sure.
Because you use it a lot.
Yeah.
Does doing crowd work or dealing with like, you know, the trolls in person in a comedy club give you any kind of edge? Cause like I am, in awe of people who can really master a crowd like that.
Sure.
They have a heckler and they can just like own the room, diffuse it, put the person down.
I think it's a slightly different skill, but I think it requires some of the same tools, but it's a little different in that like you don't have as much at your disposal in a room. I think people are meaner online, but it's easier to quiet them. You know, you could, cause like if worst comes to worst, when it's one person and not like a wave of targeted harassment that is brought on someone, you can just like block them and then they're blocked generally. And obviously it gets worse than that, but like that's the closest analog to a heckler. But with a heckler, part of what you're doing is like, you want to redirect that person or quiet them, but you can't upset the group dynamic of the room. And so for me, with my, the kind of energy and like voice that I have on stage, I can't, like, if someone's like shouting out or being annoying, which it's like not that common and especially not that common that someone would say something like, genuinely like, hey, you suck, like that just doesn't come up that much, but usually like someone will respond to your joke audibly and you just like need it to stop because it destroys the flow of the show. But I can't just be like, shut your fucking mouth, asshole, you know, because it's like it breaks the rhythm of the performance, and especially because that's not how I sound otherwise, you know, like when I'm just talking and delivering my material, it doesn't come off like that.
That's so, also not your, like, you're a nice guy.
I'm pretty nice. I try to be.
Yeah.
And so like, I don't, even if I want to say that to someone, it like curdles the room in a way that I think someone who has like a more aggressive persona on stage can get away with a little more.
Who are some comedians who are really good at crowd work?
Jimmy Pardo in LA is amazing.
What's the guy that did like an entire tour of just crowd
Todd Barry.
Work? Todd Barry.
He's great. Oh, yeah. He's so good. And I love it. And it doesn't have to be, you know, you can solicit the audience responses, and that's different and like better than dealing with hecklers, to kind of like go into the, you know, ask questions of the crowd, talk to people. And I think that's such a beautiful, dexterous art to get to watch, like watching Todd, watching Jimmy. I'm sure there's people I'm missing too, but like they just like draw things out of the audience and like turn them into enjoyable comedy for the whole room on the spot.
I'm that is a skill I don't have at all.
And
I can only imagine, like, especially because it's so unpredictable, you have to be so good at improv.
Yeah.
And it feels like such a slippery slope, because if you lose, you can lose the room like that.
Sure.
And if you lose the room and you're up there on stage,
yeah,
that's got to be a very lonely experience.
If you're doing it at the level where you're like, I'm doing an hour of crowd work, like it's pretty good. Like you're probably pretty good. Or if I do any crowd work, it's like to bolster material or because something happened unexpectedly in the room and I want to talk about it. You know, someone has an interest, reacted to a joke in an interesting way, and I want to draw that out. Or like someone just has like an interesting vibe, or like I'm in a city and I'm curious about something and I want to ask about it. So I usually do it pretty like goal oriented and for short bursts at a time, and like like merge back into material. But like it's really cool to watch someone just go out on the limb like that and go, yeah, this is my hour, is I'm just going to talk to people in the crowd and like respond. There's Jim Colladen, who's like opens for Brian Regan a lot, but I know him from New England, is like really great at that too. And just like kind of going around the room and drawing everything together. And I mean, like it's different than crowd work, but like watching Desus and Mero improvise together on set or listening to their podcast is like really joyful in that way too. It's like they're just creating, they're taking like the kernel of an observation that happens in the moment and like frothing up something really exciting.
Well, you write about a set that you did in Boston. I think you were opening for John
Oliver.
You did a little of this. You went out and jabbed the crowd.
That was fun. But that was like so managed, right? So I opened for Oliver at the Wilbur Theater in the Theater District in Boston. And it's like somewhere between 11 and 1300 seats, I think. And it was New Year's Eve and the crowd was just super juiced, super packed. John's fans are really wonderful. The people that go see him live. And I think it was the fourth of four shows we were doing together. And I was just opening for him. And I'd asked to do it because my family is from the Boston area and I was going to be home for the holidays and thought it would just be like a real fun end to the year. So I had one drink before the last show, which is 10 o'clock on New Year's Eve. And I came out and I said, which is true. I said, it's very meaningful to be here. I grew up 8 miles away from here. I've seen shows here. I love it. I started comedy two blocks from here. This is really special to me to be here. And I'm so glad to share this night with you. And people, there's like kind of a quiet, warm applause. And I said, that said, I did move to New York City 3 years ago because I wanted to be happy and successful. And they turned fully against me, which I knew would happen, openly booing, which is like not at all common. Like I've only seen someone get like boo like maybe 5 times ever. And
was it playful booing or was
it was and it wasn't. Like I don't think it wasn't final booing. It wasn't like get off the stage boo, but it was like we don't like what you said boo.
It's interesting that there's a spectrum to booing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. You can tell the kind of heat behind it, right? Like but they were playing. That was the response I was trying to elicit, right? Was like their displeasure. And I said, after that happened, I said, you're not allowed to boo. You can't boo me for leaving. Like you guys could all go if you wanted. Goodwill Hunting isn't science fiction. And that got more boos. And then I started doing jokes and like, they were a good crowd. Like they're like a well-behaved crowd, I guess, in that like they didn't just tune out and start talking. Like they were there to see John. They had like some trust that I was there for a reason,
right?
And so I started doing material and got like an applause break off a joke, you know, like next. And I said, no, I don't want your applause because you've decided you didn't like me and you have to stick to it. You already you picked a side. And it was so fun. And there is like you're on stage enough, you can kind of like anticipate and orchestrate responses to things. Like a lot of, you know, a joke that is where you get something wrong on purpose to kind of like get the put to like unsettle the audience a little bit and like have them kind of be like, what is that? And you know, you can feel it. And it's like a really fun part of the medium is to get to like, that's why the live performance element is so fun, is that like you're in the room feeling this energy, and not in any mystical way, but like if the audience is confused, you know, or if the audience is like delighted, you know, or if they disagree, if you say something they disagree with, you can feel them pull away. And then to like reel it back in is like a very fun thing
Triumph.
To do.
It's yeah. gotta be such a good feeling.
It's really fun. And some people are like real experts at it and can build, you know, an hour around like, I'm going to around this push and pull. And I think it's not generally how I operate, but it is like a really fun trick. Not trick. It's like a really fun skill to watch. I don't mean to trivialize by saying, you know, it's like a parlor trick. It's like it's like juggling, which is also an incredible skill when you do it well.
Yeah, right.
I have a friend who's a juggler where you're just like, oh, yeah, like I can't do that. And like your being able to do that is worth people paying to come see you do it.
Well, and I imagine too, like if you're doing that push-pull act and you're really good and skilled at it, that it would help you to cement a very deep level of trust with audiences.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're like, oh, so this is the game.
Yeah.
And like, I know this guy or this woman's going to they're going to bring me back.
Yeah. And you can, I think when audiences expect that from you, it's like fun to find, I imagine it would be fun to find different ways to push away and different ways to bring people back, you know, because like it could kind of get stale if you just say something disagreeable, but like if you're just like, this thing that you like, I hate. Like you know, that's like the entry level version of it. And then if you say something like, if you can write a bit that's good enough to be like, I don't enjoy Beyonce, and because people will revolt. There will be in the streets, people picketing you.
No, I said on Twitter like once. I was like, I think Solange is more compelling than Beyonce.
Wow!
And people were just like, oh,
really?
Like I got some.
Really?
I got frozen out a little.
Yeah.
bit.
Yeah, but if you can write a bit that's good enough to like bring an audience around, that then that's like a pretty exciting and compelling piece of performance. But like you can't just keep doing that, right? Like you can't just be like, I also don't like pizza, you know. It's like
yeah.
You get exhausted. But like if you can there's some really like it's just so fun to watch someone put out something that's like an ugly thing about themselves and then bring an audience around to like, all right, I see you.
Yeah, right.
It's so fun. But again, that is like not remotely my skill set on stage. I think mine, it's almost, I mean like the closest thing I have, it's almost like trying to drag people along behind the wake of my enthusiasms rather than saying something that they're like repulsed by, to say something that they're just like, no way, and then like bring them around. Like I have a joke about I love having in-laws. It's on my album I did on Corden earlier this year, and it's like a fun way to get that friction with the audience because people audibly are like, huh? And you get a lot out of that, out of like putting something out that is not controversial for controversial's sake, but like, here's my thesis. And I'm going to defend it. And when you can bring people on board of like, even if they're not mad at you, if they're like confused, like, wait, why, how do you feel that? And then you comedically back up that thesis. It's just like such a fun, and it keeps people engaged rather than, you know, like, cause they have a stake in it.
Well, yeah. And you play with their expectations a little bit. You subvert those expectations.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about like your trajectory as an artist, because I get some people in here. I've had like a surprising number of authors in here who have played in bands.
Oh, cool.
Like that happens.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, I was in a band and then, you know, now I'm writing novels or whatever. And then I'm trying to rack my brain. I think I've probably had one or two or three people who have been up on stage as comedians. My brain is so bad, but it's unique is my point.
Oh, interesting.
And so in terms of the sequence, like you are from Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to be a comedian first?
So it's all kind of mushed together. I think when I was a little kid, I thought it would be cool to be a comedian. And then I went to college thinking I was going to be maybe a playwright, which is like, I didn't realize at the time, but like numerically, probably much rarer than being a working stand-up comedian, right? Because like a Christmas party in every city, there will be a comedian at one of those. It's like, they're not commissioning plays for every like holiday party or like hot youth hockey fundraiser or whatever. And so I went into college thinking I was going to write that. And I pivoted pretty quickly to being a fiction major, but also at the same time, between freshman and sophomore year, I started doing stand up.
Where'd you go to college?
Brandeis, okay. Just outside Boston, in Waltham, Massachusetts. So, but when I graduated, I was doing stand-up at a low-grade professional level. I was getting paid to perform most weekends. But, you know, I'd be making $50 to $300 or maybe less.
per
weekend.
Yeah.
So I would do three shows for $100 each at a club or something, or I would do one show for $25. And so I wasn't doing it at the level where it was like a part-time job. And I still thought, like, when I graduated, I was like, okay, I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to write, maybe short stories. That's what my thesis was. I wrote a book of short stories as a fiction thesis at Brandeis. And
as an undergraduate?
As an undergraduate.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It was cool. I was a creative writing in English double major and a Spanish minor.
What was this, Mrs. Walensky?
Yeah.
The Spanish teacher.
My Spanish teacher from high school.
That's like you triumphed over her with the Spanish minor.
I felt good. I knew that I would. She wasn't going to like scare me off it. And, but yeah, she was my high school nemesis was this Spanish teacher who just like didn't like me, which I can't stand. I am like an extreme people pleaser. And the fact that I just like rubbed her the wrong way destroyed me.
I have some of that too.
Yeah.
I don't like it when somebody doesn't like me, and I will like be like, I'm going to try to find a way to win you to my side.
Yeah. It's so, on some level, I think it is healthy to want to build bridges, but on another level, I get so envious when I see someone that's like, fuck me, fuck you.
Yeah, right.
And you're like, oh, what a clarity you must move through the world with.
right. Instead of this fog that I live
yeah, in. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Of like, is it me? And like, which I think, again, a healthy impulse to be like, okay, let's take the temperature of this room. Did I do something messed up? Is there a way I could treat this person better or more in line with how they like to be treated? I think that's reasonable, but I think as a young person, especially, I took it to like an extent of like, well, they have to like me because if not, this all just crumbles.
Right.
So I left thinking maybe I was going to write, and I just like didn't really write much for a few years. I was writing for the stage and I was teaching preschool and I was tutoring, but I didn't like sit down.
Wait, writing for the stage?
Like for stand up.
Oh,
like
right.
I would write,
oh, okay.
I would write for my act, uh-huh. but I would all the time that I had for writing would go into jokes. And I didn't spend a lot of time writing stories or scripts or essays or short humor pieces. And so those were kind of like, those years, they weren't lost years creatively, but they were like, oh, I wasn't pushing my career forward. I was getting good at stand-up, which helped, but like, it's so, of all the people that work in comedy, the percentage I think that are just stand-ups and make like a comfortable, healthy, sustainable living from stand-up, it's just like a slice, right?
It's like the novelists.
Yeah.
You know,
yes,
who do it.
Right.
Same thing.
It's like, right. It's amazing. And so it's like, it's like saying, well, I don't want to teach. I don't want to copyright. I don't want to, whatever it is, other writers, I don't want to submit essays and short stories to publications but when I'm between novels, like I am a novelist and I write novels and like I know people who are novelists, and it's like it takes so much talent and perseverance and sometimes just like hoping that the great book that you write finds an audience instead of being a great book that gets sold and then sits on the shelves and then sits on the used book, you know, goes to the Strand and is sold for like $6 if anyone buys it. You know, like there is like a level of luck involved in like things catching on in that way.
No doubt.
And having that kind of zeitgeist, even if there's not luck in like writing a good book. So I was just writing for stand-up, which was like, I'm not, this was, you know, I was in my early to mid 20s then.
Did you first go on stage as a comedian?
For real, like I'd done a couple little things when I was like in high school, just like at like my friend booked this local church and threw like an event there or whatever. But for real, I count, the first time I like went on stage at a comedy club and performed stand-up comedy was between my freshman and sophomore year in college.
And you don't strike me like in person or in your book as the kind of typical like deep childhood wound comedian.
No.
Like, you had a good, like, family upbringing, like, healthy, like, parents are great.
Yeah, my parents are awesome.
Sister's
they remain
great.
Awesome. My sister's the best.
Yeah. So you're, like, a happy, healthy...
I try.
...individual by, you know, generally speaking. I don't mean to be too... You know, it's a little trite, that whole thing about, like, the wounded artist, comedian, actor, or whatever.
Sure.
But there is some truth to it.
And I think you can create really wonderful art from pain and trauma. And I think that is can certainly feel like really beautiful, moving, or hilarious work. But I also think, like, when people list it as a prerequisite for making any art worth enjoying or absorbing, I think that's a little misguided when people talk like that. Like, oh, you can't be funny, or you can't have a depth of understanding because you're not deeply damaged. Damaged is such, like, a judgy word, but because there is not an injury or an illness or a wound in your past that, like, is the wellspring of creativity. I just don't, like, I don't buy into that.
Do you ever have that thing, like, you would, like, look at a memoir? I mean, this is, like, a really, like, it's somewhat jokey, but there's a grain of truth to it, where I do sometimes feel like, wow, I wish something would happen, like, something.
For sure.
So then I would have this book to write, and maybe that's just, like, you know, mourning my own, like dry well of creativity or whatever.
I think, sorry, I'm, like, creaking in the chair.
That's all right.
I think that is, I have had that feeling at various points of, like, I wish something would happen. But, like, I don't think that I'm also okay with making work and we'll say art that, like, people are comforted by and is, like, soothing and resonant in that way, that it's like, oh, this was, like, a real, this was a pleasure. It didn't, like, I don't think my stand-up people or even my book, people will read it or watch it and go, like, this shook me to my goddamn core, right? Which, like, but that's not my goal. And I don't necessarily have that book in me, certainly not as, like, memoir or nonfiction. But I think there can be great value in work that is, like, that resonates in different ways.
I think so. And I think, I got to be honest, like, I got enough heaviness in my own life.
Sure.
And you become an adult, you live long enough, you go through enough stuff, even if it's not of, like, the cinematically awful variety.
Yeah.
You get to a point where it's like, I don't know if I can deal with a book where it's like, oh my, like, I know Sophie's Choice is, like, a masterpiece, but I don't know if I can read it before bed.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to put it
right
out there.
That's like, when are you reading it that you have the emotion? When are you reading something that you have the emotional fortitude to take it on? And sometimes it's so worth it, right? Like, and if you can muster it, like, my wife has a much greater, like, fortitude for that kind of thing, like reading a book that is really emotionally affecting and, like, and absorbing that experience and letting that kind of, like, inform and nourish her. And for me, I just, like, I sometimes want just to be, like, I want to be entertained, and not in a way that's necessarily ignorant of the world, but I like when something both, like, reflects the world and brings, like, either reflects or adds joy to it, as opposed to, like, the, like, a punishing emotional depth, which is deeply valuable and so commendable, but it's just, like, not the entertainment that I crave often.
Well, and you got to be true to yourself too, not only as a consumer of art, but as a creative.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to kind of track your progression creatively and professionally.
Sure.
And we'll get to the book, but I feel like there is an interesting story to be told about you being in Boston, doing stage work, teaching preschool, mm-hmm. and then deciding to move to New York.
Yeah.
And, like, was there a plan? Like, give us an idea of, like, what you were thinking when you came to New York.
So I was dating someone. I'd started dating someone who lived in New York, and my stand-up career had kind of grown to a place where I thought it would have taken me a long time to
get further than where I was in Boston. Like, I could keep writing more jokes. I could keep improving on stage for sure. I wasn't like at some kind of creative zenith, but there also just weren't that many more opportunities than I was enjoying at the time for someone at my approximate skill level and level of like local renown. So I thought that it was a great confluence of circumstances where my girlfriend was in New York at the time. And I was like, you know, I could make this kind of professional leap was the thought. So I left my preschool job and I moved to New York with the plan being,
I have to go see about a girl.
I have to go see about a girl, but it's like, I also have to go see about a job.
Right.
Like, it was like all the things were in line. It wasn't like I was pursuing my romantic life at the expense of my creative or professional life. I was like, this person is here and I like spending time with her. And there are all these professional opportunities. So if either one of those or both of those don't work out, I can always come home. Like, that's what, because there was like an ego thing at first about, oh, if it doesn't work out, whatever that means in New York, and I come back to Boston, then I'll feel like a failure. But then it kind of took me wrestling that to the ground and saying, no, it's not that I will have failed. It's that I will have decided it is not for me. Like, it doesn't mean that I failed at New York to go, oh, what it would take to thrive here is more than I can bear, or the quality of life here is not what I want. And that's no one's failure. And if people, that's no failure. And if people think it is, if people are like, you failed at this, then that is their projection onto me. Like, it wouldn't have felt good to go, oh, I couldn't accomplish these dreams. But I think there's like a great value as well in going, oh, this is the level that I'm working at, and I'm going to enjoy and appreciate the fruits of that labor rather than like pine after some career that that could have been.
So what did you get to New York? There's a girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
You start to go to the clubs around town and try to get time. Like, how does that work? You just show up and say hi?
There was kind of an idea that that's what you do, which I've never found super fruitful. But it was like, I would go to open mics. I had plenty of friends in New York already. People had moved from Boston. People had moved from other cities. People who I knew from previous visits or their visits to Boston. So I felt pretty enmeshed in the community pretty quickly, which is very fortunate. But so I was doing open mics, and then friends or people that saw me at open mics or people that I could email would book me on mostly like independent shows, bars, alternative venues, very little at the clubs for a while. I bombed my ass off at Caroline's really early on, opening for my friend Mike Kaplan, who's amazing. And, you know, I just like wasn't,
what is it like to bomb?
It's horrible. It's tough. I'm much better at it now, at bombing.
How do you get, like, give me an example of how you get good at it. Like, but basically the crowd isn't clapping or they're not engaged.
Yep.
Jokes are dying. You might start to get self-referential on stage, I would imagine.
Yeah, so I think it's a little less self-reference is very helpful, because sometimes people are enjoying quietly. Sometimes it's just not a room. Like, sometimes you're just in a room that is not well situated for comedy. Like, it's just sometimes you're in a place where it's just not going to go well for anyone, you know, and it doesn't make sense to like self-flagellate or to lash out when instead you can just kind of like perform to the best of your ability. And then it's like, well, and a good evening to you all, you know, like you'll perform for seven people in a bar, and they all came in separately and didn't really know there was going to be a show, and you're bombing, but it's not like, it's a different level of frustration than when you're in a room of 300 paid customers eating it. So like, I think calibrating your expectations is really helpful and helps you like be more in your own skin, as opposed to being like, but these jokes worked so great last night.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you like them? And like switching gears a little more to like, you know, adjusting your energy level and just being the comedian that the room needs a little more is something that I've gotten better. Even if it doesn't make it go great, I think there's a valor in like doing your best and not like melting down on stage and taking it less personally once you get off. I think that's really helpful too, to not be like, well, this went this didn't go great. I wasn't carried off on the audience's shoulders, so I'm a piece of trash. I think that, like, getting good at bombing is just like, this will happen, and, like, maybe I was trying new stuff that didn't go well, but that is an important data point in the evolution of this hour that I'm working on or whatever. So obviously the goal is for that not to happen that often, but if you're not leaving any room for the possibility that it can go badly, you're not, you're probably not trying new things. You're probably not, exiting your comfort zone very much, and that's fine. But it's like, I like to do, that's part of the endeavor for me.
I don't think you can ever do great work in any creative field if you're not willing to risk a little bit.
It doesn't have to be, right. Again, you don't have to be tearing yourself open every night and doing, like, laying yourself bare in a risky way for audiences, in front of audiences. But I think it is the more you're willing to risk, maybe the greater the reward. And yeah, I think so. Risk in terms of, like, because even if you're not writing deep, intimate details about your own life, I think there's also a, and I don't mean to speak for anyone or to even, I hope this doesn't sound like a dig at all. Jim Gaffigan is one of my favorite comedians. I think he's incredible. But there is, like, a risk to going on stage and being like, I'm going to talk about traffic cones for 7 minutes. And, like, you know, when he's working out new stuff, he'll do stuff like that. He'll come up and just be like, here are all my jokes about XYZ, and just go through them and see what works and what doesn't. Whereas if he only did the one that he was like, I know this one will work, you don't get that rounded bit that's like, there's ebb and flow and there's dynamism in there. You kind of just get the, like, the Ramon song version of that act.
Right. You know, and it's funny because I think from like a documentary film perspective, and just maybe the world, like the social media, the world that we live in, like a lot of the veils have been lifted in terms of how the sausage is made in Hollywood and elsewhere. And like watching how, like, the very best comedians, like you see Chris Rock go on stage to work out new material and just fucking bomb.
Yeah.
And that's the way that it goes. That's how you do it. You know?
Yeah. And it's great that to know that, especially as an artist, like as an audience member, maybe you like seeing behind the curtain. Maybe you just want to see the hour when it's done. But like as a creative person, it's so comforting to know that Chris Rock doesn't step on stage night one of working out this new hour, kill end to end, tour it and just get it even better, and then record it. You know, it's so like soothing to know that that's part of the process forever.
For Whereas everyone.
It could feel painful to go, I'm opening myself up to this all the time. Every time I try something new, there's the risk it will fail. But like knowing that that's part of it, I think is comforting, right?
How do you you say you've gotten better at it. You know, the emotional strength that you got to have, like the sort of knowledge of self, sense of perseverance, like that's just something you've been able to work out. Like, do you have to go to like therapy?
I should probably. I think that would enrich my life. I have not. I'm not like a regular therapy goer.
Me neither. I need it though, I think.
I think, I don't know what's keeping me from it. I think there's like, I have a sense of like, well, things are good, but like, that doesn't mean they couldn't be better. And I'm like, I sometimes feel like I need to invest more in like making things better rather than being okay when they're good. But like the things that keep me emotionally level are like with things going badly on stage or like in show business at large are like, it's really helped to have a human being life that I love to go back to when I'm not doing professional things. And I love to not even go back to, that's the baseline of my life is like, I wake up in bed with my wife and our fat little dog and like, it's the best. And that's so helpful. And it doesn't have to be like, I mean, I feel like my life is in a wonderful place, but it doesn't have to be all good for it to be a refuge from the professional stuff or like a, the dominant mode other than the professional stuff. Like needing everything to go well professionally is a really hard place to be in because like audiences aren't there for your well-being and like networks aren't there for your well-being. I think it's Marc Maron who has the saying of like, show business isn't your dad.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah. It's really true. It's like, they're not, they don't exist. Like the professional structures that you work within don't exist, in conversation with you. You're just like working amongst them. Whereas like my wife doesn't exist for my well-being, but like we are for each other. And so like, when something goes badly on stage, the audience doesn't, they have no vested interest in like how I feel about it or think about it, but I have places I can go back to where like it is good. I have like a very happy, loving home life. And like, that's it. You know, if I bombed every night for a year, I still get to like have brunch with my wife and watch movies with her and travel. And like, that's obviously, if I bombed every night for a year, I would rethink numerous things. But like, it is so good to not need every set to go well, because that's like where I find happiness.
You got some balance.
Yeah, the balance is really important. And I see that. But at the same time, not to be a devil's advocate about it, I was out of balance for years, partly because balance wasn't possible. Like when I was trying to get to where I am now, I think I was a worse romantic partner to people I've dated in the past. And I don't feel good about that. I'm not like, well, it's for my art. But I just wasn't in a place. It was like anybody who works long hours to get to a place where they can work shorter hours. I feel bad that people with their own lives and subjectivity were like, I didn't give them the best of me always, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you live and learn.
Yeah.
If it was easy to find that equilibrium, we would all be doing it, you know?
Yeah.
You're going to have to take some knocks and make some mistakes to get there.
Totally. And like, I don't even consider some of it a mistake in terms of like, I'm glad that I put in the work that I put in, but I also wish that I wish I'd like considered more how that affected other people. And like, maybe there were times where I like wasn't in a place to be in a relationship, but like you can do well enough that like you're maintaining, but you're not like growing a relationship.
Right.
And I think I had been there a couple of times, like in my 20s, where it was like, oh, I like this person. We like spending time together, but like there, if it came to like, having to skip something of theirs to like try to advance my career, like I probably would have gone the career way, which is like not a good place to be. Whereas now I think I'm less hungry for career success and like way more willing to go, you know, this would be fun, but I promised that we would have dinner with your parents, and honoring that is like what's important to my life.
Right. Well, what about getting to John Oliver, going from working stand up, making your way in New York to getting a great, that's a plum writing job.
It was awesome.
For
yeah.
anybody who works in
so
comedy.
Great. I was so fortunate to have that happen. I was doing stand up. I was writing little humor pieces, magazine articles, and tutoring. When I moved to New York, I stopped teaching full time, but I still had this tutoring hustle that was like the job that paid a lot of the bills.
These are like with the kids of people on the Upper East Side or something.
Yeah. A lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of, the 60s through the 90s.
Yeah.
I don't know that I like ever left Manhattan with this, but that's just partly because that's where the tutoring agency was. But yeah, I would go do house calls and stuff, and it was, that was the zone. I had a couple people in the low hundreds, and, but it was great. It was like a very, I liked the work, and it paid well enough that I didn't have to work 40 hours to like pay my rent with three roommates and whatever.
Right. Right.
So I was doing that. I had a kind of big viral parody Twitter account, which sounds so silly to say, but my friend Jack Moore and I co-founded the Modern Seinfeld Twitter account.
Right.
And that, got both of us a bunch of opportunities to start doing new things. So like after that kind of popped open.
How many followers?
It like peaked at like 800,000.
Jesus Christ.
Truly bonkers. And so after that kind of exploded, it was like $100,000. It was not that. It was 100,000 followers within several days, like within 3 or 4 days. And that kind of got us the attention to like, I was able to start applying to late night shows mostly. That's what I was doing. Because I didn't have a great script to shop around. Like I just...
Did you have an agent?
I didn't. And I had a manager that I was kind of... that I was working with. She, a friend of mine, became a manager. And so she was helping me out with certain things. But when this parody Twitter account happened, it like was enough to push her boss to be like, we have to sign this guy with this agency or this management company. So, and that helped a lot. And so I applied to like 20 jobs in a year, like, which is like almost all of them had unique writing requirements. So
like, was, are these jobs listed on like indeed.com?
No. So a lot of them came through, most of them came through my manager. Some of them came through like a friend being like, hey, this place that I work is hiring. But because of the level I was working at, I didn't have that many friends that had writing jobs yet. Like there were people that I would see around and talk to, but they weren't like necessarily close enough with me, or like I hadn't put myself on their radar enough with my work that they would be like, oh, we got to get this guy to submit. So sometimes it would be that. And then other times my manager would just be like, Daily Show is looking for someone, write these submission requirements, or Fallon is looking for monologue people, do this. And so I did like probably 19 or 20 of those in a year. One of them turned into a very small amount of work for Billy on the Street, which was really fun. And like that was in like July or August of this year, basically straight of just submitting. And which was like enough to buoy me to the end of the year of like, cool, maybe this is possible. Maybe my dreams are not in vain and that I'm like on the right track. And this viral Twitter moment wasn't like the only, the high watermark of my career.
Right.
And so even though I'm so grateful for like what it helped me accomplish later. So I applied as a writer for Last Week Tonight in December. Did a second submission that they went out to like a smaller group in January. And then in February was hired to do their like digital social stuff, which is really cool. It was cool to be on the ground floor of a new show, watching it come together, being a part of the team, even though I wasn't writing for the show. And then after the first season, they had the budget and the whatever the need, I guess, for another writer. And they moved me to write for as a staff writer.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was really exciting. It was such a thrill.
And he seems like such a nice guy.
Yeah, he rules. He's great.
Like he's like what you see is what you get.
Yeah.
It's not like
really smart.
Like off stage he's like a monster.
No, not at all. No. He's really wonderful. He's so smart, so funny, works so hard, like really sets the tone of like, okay, we show up and we do the work and we get it as good as we can. That's what we do. We work on it until it's the way we want it, which is like a very aspirational style of work, you know, to like not just go like, man, good enough.
Yeah. And he's warm with fans. Like, I mean, like being famous seems like a hard gig to me.
He's really, I haven't seen him with fans that much, but like when someone would like bring their parent to a taping or you know, partner to a taping and they ran into him in the hall or popped their head in to say hello, he was always like so pleasant and generous in terms of just saying like being like really kind and appreciative of the person coming to see the show and like always saying something nice about the person that works for him. And just like, he has like a very kind touch in those situations. And I think he understands what people want from those interactions.
Sure, yeah.
And like knows how much he can give and still without being like, and we're all going partying. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
He, like that's an unnecessary amount of access, I think.
Well, and but, it just, it would deplete anybody, I think, unless
I think so. Unless you're like an extreme extrovert.
Right. Well, and the reason I ask is that I'm a, because he, you know, he's a Daily Show guy. That's where he came up.
Yeah.
And I happened to see Jon Stewart. My wife works on the ESPY Awards.
Oh, cool.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but she's done that, you know, gig every summer for many years. And I go just because I
That's
can.
Fun.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm a sports fan. And congratulations on your Pats, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
What an embarrassment of riches you're living through.
Yeah, Tom Brady locked up till he's, I think they signed him until he's 56. Yeah.
But
until his Social Security benefits kick in, he's going to play quarterback for the Patriots.
But anyway, like just short anecdote. Like I saw Jon Stewart at the show because he was there to give like a courage award to like a vet, you know, because he has these causes that he believes in.
Yeah, he's like really the 9/11 first responders.
I mean, amazing to watch his advocacy. I'm like, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah.
And I'm not the person who will ever go up to anybody.
Sure.
I just don't do that. I don't do selfies. I don't do autographs seem idiotic to me.
Yeah.
But unless you're a kid.
Yeah, I think that's sweet. That's sweet for a kid. Or like, and a selfie, I understand the desire for a selfie. I'm so self-conscious about that kind of stuff.
I fucked it up with Megan Rapinoe.
No.
Because I was like, this is the one where I was like, because they had just won and she was right there. And I was like, and then she just kind of like walked past me and I was like, don't ever fucking ask.
Oh, it's
always
so
stupid.
It's so vulnerable to ask for. I as like a comedy person, I feel like unless it's somebody that I like, if it's somebody that I like work with for on something, maybe I would ask for, you know, if I like opened for someone and we had a good rapport, maybe I'd be like, can we ask for, or I would just hope somebody else took one with the two of us and steal, or like, you know, ask for the permission to repost it myself.
Well, I, you know, but this Jon Stewart thing just, and I,
oh
I,
yeah, yeah.
I,
sorry.
No, it's all right. I have, I have like a semi point. But the experience that I had was making eye contact with him as I was like walking my daughter to the bathroom or whatever, because he was down in the front. And it was like a moment, a brief moment of recognition where I was like, oh, like Jon Stewart. Mm-hmm. And he was looking at me. And the vibe that I was getting is like, don't you fucking dare talk to me. And like, kind of like an, like anger. Like
interesting.
And like, I don't think that... I don't think that he's an asshole or anything. I don't know him. You know, I cannot imagine from the totality of the work that I've seen of his that he's not, like, in private, like, a good and decent human being.
Yeah.
I don't mean to insinuate that, but, like, one of the things that I've sort of intuited about him, like, in the wrapping of his show where he just sort of vanished a little bit.
Yeah.
And in, like, you can see it in his advocacy work for 9/11 is that I think he's kind of traumatized by the work that he did and ingesting all of the bile of our political system and its toxicity day after day after day. And I think it really took a toll on him in ways that people don't necessarily appreciate.
I wonder if you're right. I mean, like, I would understand how it could be that way. And when I imagine when you are at that level of fame and people know your work so well, they want more than you can give, and they might not understand that. And I have so much sympathy for, like, I have so much understanding of wanting that moment with somebody, but then, like, it's like, I don't think everybody, either you want too much, which is possible, right? You want like an interaction that you couldn't possibly have, like, hey, you're my hero, and then Jon Stewart goes, let's be best friends or whatever, which is like, that's not gonna happen,
right?
Or you don't exactly know what you expect from that, and so it, not you, but like one might not know what to expect from that like interaction, and so it kind of like it's now like Jon Stewart's job or whoever's job to like manage that and wrap it up. And like, I think almost everybody, unless you're bothering them while they're doing something else or is a jerk, likes to hear like, hey, your work means a lot to me, thank you. And like, I think it, unless you're like interrupting someone's dinner, that doesn't seem like too much to put on someone. But then beyond that, it's like, I always think when I see or meet someone that I like really admire, it's like, well, other than that, what am I adding to their day?
It's when you stand there for like an extra 15 seconds after you have that micro exchange where it's like, hey, your work means a lot to me. Hey man, thanks. And then you're just like silent standing there.
Right. Cause it's like, it's not like whoever that is going to go like, and I really like what you do too, you know, like it's not, and I say that, and I don't mean that, I'm not trying to belittle people who aren't in creative fields. I mean like myself, like if I met, you know, whoever.
The Coen brothers.
That's a perfect example. And I was like, I love your film so much. I couldn't expect them to be like, cool man. And we are big fans of all of your work. I'd be like, what? You know, that just isn't going to happen.
But come over for dinner.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But so I think just knowing that and going in like not
craving anything other than like the ability to tell someone that you appreciate them, because it is such an asymmetrical relationship.
So your book.
Yes.
You know, you're working on all this TV, and it's like the way that your book reads in total feels like memoir-y.
Thank you.
Like I get a real sense of the arc of your life. I mean, at least like the bits and pieces that you share, but it does like, you know, it forms a reasonably full picture.
Thank you.
From childhood to kind of where you are now.
Sure.
But it's not like the exhaustive, like in third grade, you know, like it's more like, you know, you pick these moments that are definitive or illustrate something in particular. And I guess I'm curious if that was the conception from the start, or if you were just kind of writing these pieces disparately, and then you eventually realized that you had a book.
So I went in, that's a great question. I start every answer with so. I'm like realizing that about myself, and it is, you know, something for me to hate later. I came in to the, when I started writing the book, I wanted it to have like a fullness to it and an arc to it. And I didn't come to the proposal knowing what that was. And it's like a great credit to my agent, Noah. And my
Noah who?
Ballard.
Okay.
And Stephanie Hitchcock, my editor, that we got it to the place where it is now. And I think I came in with like Noah kind of when I was working on the proposal, give me lots of good advice about making it feel like it's the whole book is on theme and there are like things to take away from it that feels like a unified work. And then with Stephanie, I would turn in essays and drafts and
your editor?
Yes.
At
Harper Perennial.
Yeah.
And a lot of my big questions were like, am I sticking this landing of like, does it feel like I'm putting building a house with all these bricks, or is it just like, hey, that's a bunch of neat bricks you piled up over there? And at first it wasn't there. At first it was like, I wasn't the emotional heft wasn't quite where it is now, and the themes and ideas that I really wanted to like highlight weren't as foregrounded. And she gave such great notes and made such great edits of like thinning out stuff that was maybe fun but didn't get to the heart of the matter, or bolstering things that like being like kind of digging to a greater depth of sincerity instead of like kind of glib jokes across the surface. And it was like a really, so it was the intent from the beginning, but it was not an immediate success. And working with them was really helpful and informative to the work as it is now.
Well, then they did their job. That's great.
They sure did.
That's what you, I mean, what you hope for.
They're amazing.
For.
Like I've worked with Noah for a long time, and we started working together before I had like really much going on at all. And he just liked, someone sent him a blog I was writing. And I say, I mean, this is in the acknowledgments in the book, and I've said it to Stephanie's face, but like I met with a few different publishers and a few different editors at different publishing houses. And one of the things I liked about her immediately is that I said this to her face, that she's not impressed by my bullshit. Like, because as a stand-up and a professional writer, I can make things entertaining and like fun for a number of pages. But I liked that she wasn't going to be like, oh, that's fun, and then just like let it slide. I like that she was going to be like, no, but like, what is this about? What are we saying here? And so I think, again, I don't mean to talk in such lofty terms about my own book, which I think is mostly just like, it is I wanted it to be entertaining, but I also wanted people to come away with like a specific set of feelings that reflected my life and thoughts and stories in certain ways. And I think like, thanks to her, we got there instead of it just being like a bunch of fun stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and like, I feel like, you have to sequence things. I mean, there's a chronology that you're following, mm-hmm. but you know, when you're putting one of these collections together and you want it to feel unified and whole, like thematically, I guess to some extent narratively, that can take some time and know-how, and hopefully you get some good feedback from friends and your wife or whoever your readers are. And then you have a great agent and editor to help you sort of set it down.
It was a really cool experience to like fill it out to the point that it is now. So that like, that it's funny and fun and like
a fast read were all things that I wanted. I wanted people to just kind of be like, oh, that's wow. But also that like there, you know, that it sticks with you in at least a little way. And there's like kind of a resonance of like, oh yeah, this is like how a person thinks about the world. And to think about it in conversation with like, oh, I think the world is this way, but this was an interesting take. Or like, oh, maybe you can take something from it for yourself. Or like, even if you're like, this, I don't relate to this at all. I don't know what this guy's brain is from space. Like, at least I've articulated enough that you get where I'm coming from.
Well, I think the thing that sticks with me the most is just this notion of trying to be a nice person in a like an often shitty world.
Yeah.
And trying to sort of, you know how to navigate that and modulate, your behavior accordingly, like mm-hmm. especially when you're confronted with really extreme examples of not so niceness.
Yeah. I think it's niceness and goodness and like when it's important to not be nice and when it's important, you know, when it's valuable to be assertive or curt or like righteously angry about something and where, but how to like work towards kindness and like the value of doing that even in small moments and arenas is something that I think about a lot and like when to stand up for people and how to do that better, even when it feels difficult and not like the not the smooth way to go, but like that kind of like larger kindness sometimes supersedes niceness, even though like my inclination is just like, hey, thanks. Cool. Yeah.
Right. Well, I enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed talking with you. Are you
Thank
working
you so much.
Are you working on another book? Or?
Not yet.
Okay.
I didn't want to rush into something just because I was done with this project. So I'm taking a little time to like recalibrate and think about what the next big thing I want to work on my own is, which is very exciting.
And you're writing for TV,
mm-hmm.
and you're doing stand-up.
Yeah.
And so people can get your album. They can watch your show on TV.
Yep.
We're going to plug your website.
Thank you.
Are you doing any tours, like comedy dates that we should
know
about?
Yeah, I've got, I don't know exactly when this is coming out, but like my website, joshgondelman.com, has all the book events that I'll be doing and it's like updating all the time. And, like I'm waiting for West Coast. I'm doing some West Coast stuff, hopefully like at least LA and San Francisco, maybe some festivals that haven't filled in yet. Adding Philly and Rhode Island soon, but like I've got a bunch of New York events already.
You do stand up at your book events?
Some of them are some of them are shows with books for sale. Some of them are like an in conversation with. Some of them are reading signings. It all depends on the venue, and I feel like pretty adaptable to different venues. So it's like it all depends on where was interested in having me in what city and like what seemed like fun in certain places.
Okay. Yeah. Well, people can check it out at joshgondelman.com. It's good talking to you. Good to meet you.
Thank you. Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Okay, everybody. There we go. That's Josh Gondelman. His new book is called Nice Try: Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results. Available from Harper Perennial. Official publication date, September 17th, 2019. As of the airing of this program, it is about to drop. Go get your copy immediately. Order it, pre-order it, go get it. Nice Try, Stories of Best Intentions and Mixed Results. Josh Gondelman, you can find him on the internet again at joshgondelman.com. You can follow him on Twitter and get a pep talk at Josh Gondelman. I believe he's also on Instagram. You can see his work on the television with Desus and Mero, or I guess if you watch like old episodes of Last Week Tonight. Or you can catch him on stage. I think he has his tour dates on his website. See some comedy. Thanks to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total, as always, for the theme song music. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music. Thank you to OR Books for sponsoring the show. Don't forget to go get Exile, the new one from Belen Fernandez. If you want to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. That's the email address. Let me know what you think. Every single episode of this program is offered freely, almost 600 and counting. It's a listener-supported show. If you want to throw a few bucks in the hat and tip your server, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. This program also has its own official app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. It's free. Go get it wherever you get your apps. It's a good app. So next week on the program, let me see here. Oh, Kimberly King Parsons is my guest.
I'd like to thank Brad for the podcast.